knock you right in the head.
You better get yourself together. Pretty soon you're gonna be dead.
Stocks and jobs.
You are out of control.
Right now.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Jimmy Lawler on the board. S&P futures up 31. NASDAQ futures up 195. This is after a day yesterday when we were actually down some. Yesterday we were down, I'll get the number here, a little bulky here on the computer. It's raining here in Chicago, it's miserable, although it's warmer. We also have a president's speech last night, which was interesting. So we have Professor Liu.
Good morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
Good. I'm operating on a slightly different platform this morning, so if you see
I can
any
tell.
Technical
I can tell.
Just let me know.
No, you're okay. It's like you're coming at us from Apollo 14, but we can hear you.
Sorry, I'm sitting in a foyer, and there might be a little bit of an echo somewhere.
This is at the Ritz, I assume.
A Westin, actually.
There you go. Well, you're only five-star right here. Five-star Lou, they call you.
So, anyway, I wanted to start out this morning, since this is, I don't know if I'll be talking to you next week. Next week's Christmas, right?
Yeah, we're Christmas and then New Year's. This is my last Lou fix. We got to get you on before that, though. Get you on somewhere.
Well, I could probably slot in there somewhere, but I just wanted to give my annual Christmas holiday party warning that was triggered by a tweet I saw this morning where some guy who said tweets out, "I'm a bartender. I work in a private corporate event, and everybody in the room plus me knows that based on what I'm watching, what I'm seeing, that the CEO and the director of marketing are filling each other's stockings.
Oh, good.
And I just want to give my annual caution about holiday parties. If there's a single event that raises the marketing profile of employment lawyers everywhere and gets us ready to start solving problems, it's company holiday parties.
Well, you know, they're almost all over here already.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're fraught with potential exposure. So we my firm regularly goes out with a sort of an email notice to clients saying, look, if you're going to do these things, it usually goes out right after Thanksgiving, but it says, if you're going to do these things, here are some tips for management. But really, the tips for management need to be the tips for the tips for the people who are actually attending. The number of just crazy things that happen, drunk because of alcohol, and it's a party, and people get dressed up, and whatever subliminal messaging that's been going on in the workplace all year seems to be boiling out of these things.
Well, you do see some of that. I mean, the bar downstairs here, it's basically a dive bar. I don't know if they'd like if I said that, but they have a lot of these, and it's kind of different. There's a lot of just the young people show up. You get a bracelet, you get beer and wine or whatever for 2 hours, and then it's kind of over. It's not a major. You do see there was one. We walked by the other week, the place, what's the name of the place on the Plaza, Jimmy Trudeau?
Yes.
Let's just say that the people walking out of there had to be 7 or 8 young ladies that were, let's just say they wanted to look a hell of a lot different than they do at work. And the guys, too. I mean, it's obviously there were, like you said, there was somebody, it was a mating game there. It wasn't just to have a few beers and go home. It was a.
It's a combination. It's just a dangerous combination. And one of the things that we try to impress upon our clients and the message that they need to send out to people is, listen, it's a party, but you're still at work.
Oh yeah.
Okay. This is still a work environment. I know it's not going to seem like that, but it is. So whatever inhibitions you have at work, you should have at the party, which means you don't drink to excess, you don't eat to excess, you don't dance to excess, you don't do anything that you wouldn't want to see on your next performance report.
Lou, how is it that
that's a really hard lesson to get across, apparently.
How is it that when I was on the SIBO board and was director of the marketing committee for a couple of years, we had to go to all these. Audrey would come with. We had to go to these. I use the term boondoggles, where we're taking member firm people and their wives to some nice place and blah blah blah. And somebody goes, "Man, you got to go like to Florida for free." And I go, "I was working." "What do you mean you were working? You played golf?" And I said, "Every place I went, every bar, I was talking to a customer of the CBOE. I was representing them. Wasn't my party. I'd much rather go out of a beer with you than do that." I think if you've never done it, you don't quite get it, Lou. You're never off duty.
I've got probably 3 cases or 4 cases in front of me right now in which some of the allegations involve corporate social events where people just go off the rails. Male and female. I mean, it tends to be the guys who get a little sloppier, or at least that was historically the way it is.
Changed.
I'm seeing now it's 50-50 and maybe even tilting slightly in favor of the women.
Well, if you are 220 pounds and you're dumb enough to have 5 shots, what if you're 110 pounds and you have the same 5 shots?
Exactly. Exactly. We used to when I was running the summer associate program for one of my law firms, we would bring these kids out, and again, these are law school students, many of them coming straight from college, they don't have a lot of experience in corporate, you know, sort of the corporate culture. And again, just a ton of social events for these kids because you're trying to sell them on the firm. And sitting them down, you literally had to sit them down and just say, look, I know you think this is outside of work. It's not. Okay? We had a really outstanding lawyer student. I recall this, you know, vividly. And this kid was brilliant. He was articulate. He wrote brilliantly. But if you've got two drinks in him, two beers in him, he turned into a lunatic.
That happens.
And it does. And you know, somebody who absolutely should not have alcohol under any circumstances.
But it's at any level, Lou. It's a couple of business trips. It's not that it's not anything to do with my history. Nobody gives a crap about that. It has to do with lessons you learn. I worked on the Boston contract, and the marketing guy was a guy named Wally Kilray, terrific guy. And he says to me, "Okay, you're a big Irish guy. I assume you drink." And I go, "Oh yeah." He says, "Now look, you're not a pro. These guys are." He goes, "What can you drink all night long without being an idiot?" I said, "Well, yeah. I can probably do Canadian Club and water." He goes, "Okay. Every time they order a drink, you get a drink. Every once in a while, you go to the men's room and you pour half foot out and fill it up with water. You can't keep up with these guys. Don't even try." And I took his advice because he goes, you're my guy. I need you articulate all night long. And oh, by the way, tomorrow morning, after 15 drinks, these guys will remember every piece of the conversation. You better as well. I'm like, oh boy, okay then.
Yeah. I mean, that's great advice.
He goes, and the next morning I walked in, Lou. I wasn't hungover because I was tossing half my drink out. And I walk in, and these guys, "Hey, remember what we said like the last thing last night about this piece of the railroad car?" Those guys, they were professional. They I don't know how they did it, but they did it. I didn't. Well,
I think you know I don't drink at all. The only place I've been that had a comparable culture was when I was working in the former Soviet Union. I've never seen anybody in my life drink the way the Russians drank. And
I've heard that, but I've never been there.
It's astounding. I would arrive at 9 a.m. or 9:30 in the morning from JFK into Moscow, and we would have a 10:30 or 11 o'clock meeting scheduled with some group of Russians, you know, that we were talking to about industrial conversion or something like that. I would go into an 11 a.m. meeting. There'd be five guys in the meeting, including me. There would be five bottles of vodka on the table. And some greasy Russians, they call them zakuski, the snacks, sausages and some bread. I loved the black bread, so I would eat that. But I literally had to tell them that I had a stomach ulcer and could not drink so that they wouldn't be insulted. But after they got to know me, it was great because they just said, "Well, it's an extra bottle of vodka for us." The meeting would go for an hour and a half, 2 hours. We'd work through all this stuff. All those bottles would be empty at the end of an hour and a half meeting.
Well, the amount of drinking at lunch here, when the guys would go back to work and they were sober as a judge.
Yeah, five liters of vodka.
That's
among four guys, and you know, they weren't cutting it. There was some water there, but they weren't drinking water. I've never seen anybody drink like that in my life, and they were functional. You know, I mean, that I think they were all going to die when they were 56, but they were functional. So anyway, the point is, I go out with our annual warning. If you're going to a holiday party at your workplace, you know, you should be twice as discreet as you would be normally.
These guys are pretty careful. They don't include any shots or anything. So I mean, if guys are doing that, they're on their own. At least they're not paying for that. I don't know how much what that gets them, but it's strictly you know, just like a beer and a wine thing. But
yeah, but we try to. I know that some of the corporate events that I've attended recently have been the only thing that was offered for free was non-alcoholic stuff. If you wanted to buy a drink, even wine, if you wanted to buy something or get something like that, you had to pay for it.
Really?
So, just the annual warning that you know, if you wanna promote my business for the next year, have a good time at your company holiday party.
Well, I know you're a busy man. You haven't followed some of the stuff on the show lately, but boy, we've been having some really interesting discussions. A lot of it is coming from some of the research Hal is doing for his new classes. He did one on the history of economic thought. Now I think he's doing one. Jimmy's a money and banker, but he's digging into some of these banking rules of the last 15, 20 years and how much they've totally turned the credit markets against smaller borrowers. And pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, we've been kind of going through the whole list of how this is all happening. And then we had a big article, I don't know if I sent it to you, about the how many shipyards we have left, which aren't very many. And how
So I follow a guy named John Conrad, who is a shipping and Navy expert, and who seems to be reasonably even keeled, if you'll pardon the pun. He's been sounding the alarm for the last 5 or 6 years about our total inability to manufacture ships and to repair them. And we don't, you know, he just looks at what China has been doing and what we've been doing, and it's ridiculous. We've basically got ourselves in a position where we've crippled NAVC, which is the Navy shipbuilding group, has effectively crippled our shipbuilding industry with its bureaucratic rules and requirements.
Did you know we were down to 6 shipyards and China has 300?
Yep. Yep.
Well, now why? There's one up in Wisconsin, and I've driven by it actually. And in fact, they used to make when we were little, we used to go up there for our vacation. I think they used to make minesweepers, but now they had a contract for 3 frigates, and they canceled 2 of the frigates and they laid off like 90. What are we doing that for? Why are we losing this expertise? Whenever I see something like this, when I was younger, Lou, I'd say it would just be a bunch of bureaucrats kind of screwing up and not realizing what they've done. Now I'm convinced that somebody somewhere is directing this stuff. Why can't we build anything here? What are we doing? I mean, not only that, you lose the capability, but you lose the guys who know how to design it. You know the guys how to put it together. You lose the steel making capability. You lose the bar next door, for God's sake. You lose the whole name. I mean, doesn't anybody have any idea about this stuff? I mean, it's the same thing. It's when I talk all the time about what happened to railroad cars. I had no idea it was happening in shipbuilding to that extent. Who does this?
Yeah, well, with respect to the military side of this, the short answer is, I come out of an Air Force culture, and I consider the Air Force. It was a great place to serve. I don't regret a day I spent on active duty or in the reserves, but the Air Force is the least intellectual of the major services, because it's run by technicians. And for technicians, and this is true of a lot of the military leadership, the thing that these guys tend to be technically oriented, and the thing that really dazzles a technically oriented person is new technology. Basic stuff like transports, minesweepers, refuelers, repair facilities, building facilities, this is not glamorous stuff that holds their attention. And this stuff needs attention. It needs a lot of attention. It needs management. It needs careful thought. And the focus has been on getting the next new thing and looking at the next new thing. And overlaying all of that is a bureaucratic morass that is dictated in part by the Pentagon bureaucratic mindset, which is disastrous, and in part by Congress, which basically says, you know, why should Connecticut or why should Georgia or why should Washington get or California get all those naval repair contracts or Navy contracts or shipbuilding contracts? We need to spread the wealth.
Yeah, but the answer now seems to be nobody gets them.
Well, and that's the issue. When you do that, you drive your decisions, your building decisions, your procurement decisions get driven not by efficiency, but by political largesse. Where can we spread the money? So we push the manufacturer of B-1 bomber. I mean, when the Air Force was building the B-1 bomber, for example, the Air Force constructed its award of contracts so that almost every state in the United States had some portion of a B-1 bomber contract. Were these the most efficient operations? No. It was a logistics nightmare because you had to ship all that stuff from all over the country to get it into the assembly plant. But it was politically, the Air Force determined that it was politically necessary if they wanted the support for the thing.
The same mentality
drives our shipbuilding, and it drives our Navy procurement. This stuff is not sexy. Why? We've been watching the Russians putting stuff into the Arctic for over a decade. They have focused on the Arctic. Do you know how many icebreakers we have?
Two or three.
Well, maybe one that's operational.
One heavy and a couple of mediums. It was all in the article.
That's right. One heavy. It's ridiculous. Are we supposed to be serious up there or not?
Well,
because we're not
going
to fly everything in.
My curiosity is always in, and you know, everybody rants at me for being so liberal. I'm not. I cannot believe the people that I say all the time, Lou, trying to be nice, that the skill set you have to get elected isn't necessarily the skill set you want in the office. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. I think it is in some of these smaller towns or smaller areas where somebody who actually wants to do a good job gets on state legislatures and stuff. I really do believe there's a lot of good people in politics, but I don't understand how I manage money all day. I do a podcast. I'm just a regular schmuck that maybe has some skills. I was never in the Army or in the military like you. Yet I've read enough to know that the reason why, well, other than industrial capacity, we won World War II was we had a guy in charge named George Marshall. It was logistics. You can't go to war without a bullet. You can't go to war without toilet paper. And our ships were, damage control was first. If a bomb hit our ship, it didn't go down. If it hit a Japanese ship, it probably went down. All the stuff that you're talking about, if you even are some dummy and read a couple of books about World War II, you'd realize that's really why we won. How do our idiots not realize that when it's right there? We did it.
The stuff that gets you promoted, if you're so Congress at some basic level defers to the generals and the admirals with respect to military needs. And if you're not focused, for example, on tankers, on minesweepers, we don't have enough minesweepers.
Do we have any?
We have some minesweeping helicopters and some other capability, but it's quite limited. If you wanted to shut down or do an area denial exercise on our Navy, all you got to do is drop a couple hundred mines in a particular area, and you make it you triple the difficulty we have in getting in and out of there, simply because we really haven't paid attention to basic stuff like minesweeping. You know, because that's not what gets you promoted. If you want to get promoted, you want to be affiliated with an aircraft carrier. Well, guess what? You know, aircraft carriers are nice and they're beautiful, and if you command an aircraft carrier, you're the top dog. But aircraft carriers right now are sitting ducks for a variety of weapon systems. And they're going to draw fire from, you know, not just other ships, but now from ballistic missiles.
And we only got about 10 of them.
Yeah, in some cases, there's a simulation, an animated history series called Flat Circle History, that's talking about the Third World War right now, and it starts with Russia going into the Baltics. But China joins in to strike Taiwan, and you know, within the first day, they shoot 100 ballistic missiles at an aircraft carrier. Guess what? The fleet defense that we have is not sufficient to stop 100 ballistic missiles No. coming in, and so they sink the carrier.
Well, do you remember? Remember better. I mean, what was the all these wars? When was the The Strait of Hormuz mined. What year was that? What war was that in?
First Gulf War.
Because I do remember reading that we sent these ships over there to clear the mines, but we didn't have enough minesweepers. So
that's right.
At the end of the day, the thing that was I found sad but hilarious was somebody determined that the double hull tanker is actually more impervious to a standard mine than one of our naval ships. So the tanker that we're supposed to be protecting was leading the way through the minefield with our ships following.
Right.
That's not exactly the way you wanted to do it, was it?
No, it's not. And it's again, basic low-tech stuff is not sexy, and it doesn't get you the stars on your shoulder. You want to be the guy that brings the new fighter, that brings the new aircraft carrier online, that brings the new tank online. You know, the guys that tend to be paying the most attention to the basic stuff are guys like the Army and the Marine Corps, because they rely on, they know what a supply chain looks like. They know what it takes to get food right to the front, or ammunition to the front, or weapon systems to the front lines. They have to worry about that. They can't leapfrog over things or sail through relatively uncontested territory. We demonstrated some fantastic logistics capability, but we have not done the basic blocking and tackling that is necessary to secure the forces that we want to put in the field. If we have to put them in against the peer enemy, it's going to be very expensive.
Well, we're spoiled by these 10-day wars.
That's right. And that one of the things that jumps out at you when you look at what China's been doing for the last 20 years, and we've seen it, we've watched it, and a number of voices have been sounding the alarm, and we've started the wheels have started turning at the Pentagon. But I mean, the Pentagon is a super tanker. You throw the wheel over to change direction, and 4 days later the bow finally starts to turn a little bit. The Pentagon has been making the moves to bring some of this stuff online. But the Navy just canceled its Constellation frigate program, which had been sitting there for like 10 years in development, because nothing had been done on it. And the Navy
So how many thousands and thousands of hours of engineering and other stuff went into the damn thing, and now it's nothing?
It conceivably could be reconstituted in another form, but the point is,
but it's a waste.
It took you 10 years to get nothing.
And how many man days?
Yeah, I know. We could have been building Aegis cruisers, other destroyers. We could have fielded, 10 or 15 of those in the meantime. But now we're at least 10 years away from having an effective frigate. And this is the stuff that needs to.
Well, those are the two canceled. Two of them just got canceled in Wisconsin.
Yes.
They had three frigates and they canceled two.
So we toss around terms like distributed lethality, where we discuss arming minesweepers and transports and fuelers and other stuff with air-to-air missiles and air-to-surface missiles. But if we don't have the hulls to put down in the water for those things, it's meaningless. We're fielding an Air Force that is, right now, probably as good as any in the world. It's stealthy. It has weapon systems that can shoot BVR beyond visual range. We haven't, those aircraft are great, but we haven't developed long range missiles. For example, China and Russia can both outshoot us in air to air capability.
I'm not sure. Well, I don't know. I've never, Wayne and Andrew, maybe I'll probably listen. Later on, I'll talk. Maybe they can talk about the individual. Why is it we don't have?
By the way,
Is it because we don't have people that used to be in the armed forces on these committees, or where's the hole? Is there one hole, or is a million holes?
So there, as I said, there are a couple of major holes. One is the priorities of the Defense Department, or the Department of War itself, which is shiny, glittery, you know, new tech, fancy stuff. You know, we want the weapon that'll do everything. That's part of it. That slows procurement down. That's being undercut to a certain extent now by places like Anduril and some of the other new startup defense contractors that are focusing on rapid production of specialized weapon systems that can be fielded almost immediately. So that hole is being partially filled. But the other big hole, Tom, is Congress and procurement. And the short answer is congressmen are not voting. They're not going to vote for a weapon system that doesn't help them directly or doesn't help their district directly. And we are not confronted, and they don't believe we are confronted with an existential threat. It would take a war, a big one, against a peer, where we start losing, you know, 1,000, 2,000 people a week, and we say to ourselves, okay, now we need to vote this thing into effect. We need to vote these weapon systems into development. And that's the biggest issue.
Well, some of it's a little somewhat natural, though, Lou. I mean, we over the last, you know, I'm going to say 30 years, how many states have gotten and all these manufacturing facilities kind of ripped away from them, and all of a sudden you want me to vote for something and another?
Yeah, that's a natural. It's a natural development in terms of you're gonna vote for what's going to get you reelected. And part of the issue, and so that's part of it. The other part of it is what I consider to be far too much deference to the Defense Department in terms of this is what we want. You know, Congress should be the idea that there would be a 10-year frigate program that doesn't produce a single boat is outrageous. And if I was Congress, I would be coming back to the Secretary of Defense and sitting down and saying, you need to fire some people.
But who in Congress, we've run out of World War II people. They're pretty much all dead, right? It seemed to me, you know, 25 years ago, a guy like Dan Inouye could sit down next to an admiral and say, hey, look, you're screwing up. Do we have people like that now?
I don't know. I mean, we have a number of Iraq and Gulf War on Terror veterans.
Those guys should be pretty good.
I would think so, but you don't see them doing that. You don't see them taking an interest. You've got Duckworth there in Illinois. We've got that idiot Crow here in Colorado. Both of those people are totally worthless, and they're not doing the hard stuff.
Why don't people do? I don't get it. When Adlai Stevenson, you know, obviously a Democrat, Mike Royko used to say, the dude would take on every hard thing and have his people write up a white paper and pass it around the Senate saying, here's a program we need to fix and here's how. Does anybody do that stuff anymore? Put their name on something where it's actually theirs, where they take responsibility and actually...
I just lost you.
I'm saying, I mean, Mike Royko used to talk, the long dead Mike Royko, he's talking about Adlai Stevenson, and he was this quiet guy. He said, but the dude would take on like every, or, you know, a bunch of different difficult problems, and he and his staff would put together a white paper saying, oh, this is not working, this is what we need to do, and pass it around for people to actually put his name on something, take the responsibility, and actually do like a white paper like people would do at college or something. Does anybody do that anymore?
I think they do in some with regard to some issues, but not to this. I mean, I haven't seen the intelligent commentary that I see on defense is all coming out of West Point. The West Point's got a fantastic group on the Institute for Study of War. There's a group at the Naval War College that does something similar. There's a working group at the Air Force Academy that puts out some pretty good stuff on the future of conflict. But, you know, for Congress people, which this ought to be their bread and butter, And what I see, you know, I don't see the expertise there. What I see the focus on in the staff, you know, the staffs of these congressional offices is on fundraising, and on whatever, you know, whatever.
Well, you got to be doing TikTok and X all day long.
That's right. And whatever is the issue du jour that boils up in Congress, because the attention span up there is getting shorter and shorter.
Why? So, but I'm just a guy who learns from people like you. I read this thing a long time ago when we had 16 aircraft carriers and 4 were out at any given time, and there was the rotation, and blah, now we're down to like 10. Okay, and say 3 are out at any given time. If there was some kind of a war, and there's spectacular things, and there's 10,000 people on them, and they project so much stuff, I have to believe that if somebody really wanted to take out the 3 that were at sea and were willing to drop like atomic bombs within 5 miles of the damn thing, somebody could take them out. And then what do we got behind it? Nothing.
Yep.
I mean, to think that as powerful as 3 ships or 4 ships are, it's not 10, because 7 of them are always here or somewhere, or 6 are being refitted or something. As powerful as they are, if somebody wants to, you know, is willing to do something like drop an A-bomb on the damn thing, they're going to be able to take it out. How come I can realize that and most people don't?
It's an unwelcome truth or an unpopular truth, which means people don't want to confront it, right?
Well, I'm convinced that probably a missile's not going to get through, or another plane is not going to get through, because we have all those people around them, and I don't think a submarine's going to get through. But if we were to send 10 Minuteman missiles at somebody's aircraft carrier, but one of them is going to get close enough, isn't it?
We wouldn't even need to do that.
I know, but I'm saying that was exaggerating.
So,
but
let me give you a scenario. So this moldy old tanker ship, you know, is sailing across the Pacific, and it's registered in Liberia. It's flying all the right flags, and it gets within 50 miles of a carrier group. You know, it's sailing in sea lanes, and it deviates slightly. We overfly it. We look at it. It's all properly vetted. It's got the right flag. It's got the right registration number, et cetera, et cetera. We go, okay, you know, stay away from the carrier. Move further away. In the hull of that thing are 10 underwater stealthy drones, and it launches them, because it's not really a tanker. It's an attack ship. And it launches these underwater drones that sail at like, and the carrier is moving in a particular direction. This vessel gets in front of the carrier and releases these drones, and they move at like 5 to 10 knots. They're very slow. They're electric, so they're very quiet, and they each are carrying, 1,000 pounds of explosive, and they're autonomous. We release them. This thing releases them, and they spread out, and then they start moving toward the tent, toward the group. And they're programmed, either go for the carrier or go for the escorts. And unless we get lucky, we're probably not going to pick them up. And they'll get within. The Ukrainians just snuck one of these things into the harbor at Novorossiysk. On the Black Sea in Russia, and detonated it next to a pier that had a submarine tied to it. Now the question, we don't know whether they were going for the submarine. I don't know whether they damaged the submarine or not. It was a huge explosion, and it looked like it got the sub. But my point is that in an active war zone where you're looking for this stuff, these things can sneak through. In peacetime, for sneak attack purposes, you would have something like this going on, where these you might launch drones.
This is sort of like the midget subs that were Pearl Harbor, right?
Exactly. And these things would slip through your submarine screen, and 1,000 pounds of explosive detonating against the hull of an aircraft carrier would be enough, not necessarily to sink it, but you could stop it in the water. Or let's say, my next question:
what is a 1,000 pounds kind of close do? What is a normal torpedo? How many pounds is that?
I don't remember whatever. I mean, that's close. That's close to what a.
But a torpedo can hit and penetrate too, though, so it's more damaging.
Yes. Yeah. But these things, 1,000 pounds of explosive going off right against the hull would damage the ship substantially. Or let's say instead of launching, 10, 15, 20 of these underwater drones, the tanker releases 1,000 airborne drones, each one carrying some kind of chemical agent, all right? And they fly along and all, you know, they land, they detonate on the flight deck of the aircraft carrier. And so now suddenly you've got nerve agent scattered all over your flight deck, or you've got, you know, and you might shoot half of them down, but they're small and they're zooming around, and they come in to attack your carrier. They land on the flight deck and detonate. They scatter chemical weapon grade stuff on the flight deck. Now you've got nerve agent on the flight deck, or they come in and they detonate, you know, 25, 30 pounds of explosive on aircraft that are parked on the flight deck, because carriers frequently have aircraft parked up there. Again, that carrier stops. Its operations stop for as long as it takes to repair that damage. These are not out of the realm of possibility, and more importantly, they can be done in a very low tech, although the autonomous underwater vehicles not so much, but if Ukraine can produce them, I'm pretty sure a number of other places can produce them or purchase them.
Who guides the things? How do you guide
them?
They're
self-guided. You set them on a course that's likely to intercept, and when they get within a certain range,
to sneak into a harbor next to a dock, that somebody's guiding that thing.
No, not necessarily. You send it. I mean, you send it on its way. It has a programmed map in there. It has a passive sonar that allows it to look for boats or look for vessels, and an underwater camera so that it recognizes, okay, now you're coming up on this dock, you're coming up on this boat, you know, work yourself in.
I think when I come back, if people are reincarnated, I might want to come back as a drone driver.
One of the things that we didn't anticipate, I don't think, is just how fast AI and AI sensor platforms were going to develop. I mean, I think I told you I took a ride in a self-driving Tesla and let it do the self-driving feature about a month ago. That was my first time in a car like that, and it's astounding. And I mean, we would not have predicted that the development of AI to that extent. To that rapidly, and it's even more developed in a number of these weapon systems. We're very, very close to just being able to turn loose automated air.
Our fallback position always was our submarines could wipe out a whole country if somebody really messed with us. Are we still at that stage or no?
If we want to go nuclear, but when the other side has nukes, You're not gonna do that, you know. I mean, at some point, with both sides having nuclear weapons, what you guarantee is a very high intensity conventional conflict, and that's what's going to happen. If
we hope.
Rather than, well, let me put it this way: the first side that uses nuclear weapons, if you cross the nuclear firebreak, the risk of catastrophic escalation, and by catastrophic escalation I mean nuclear attacks on your homeland, go through the roof.
But we're not going to totally lose a conventional war,
you know,
without using them. We're not going to let everybody rip up our whole navy without doing something.
But your political objective is meaningless if you're choice of weapons results in the destruction of your country and its economy. So nobody wants to cross that nuclear firebreak, and you don't want to push the other side to a point where it's going to feel constrained to use nuclear or required to use nuclear weapons. So these are all factors that play into.
I understand they're a factor, but I don't suppose we would just be getting our ass kicked conventionally for 3 years without doing it.
It could happen. Let me postulate a scenario. The Chinese have, there are a number of reports coming out of China that the Chinese have developed a way of tracking our ballistic missile submarines, through complicated wake analysis and thermal and other means. All right.
From where? Satellite or from? They don't have enough submarines.
From satellites or aircraft, or just observing the ocean. So let's say opening round of the conflict, we get into China. They decide they want Taiwan. We go after them. They move immediately to decapitate our leadership in Hawaii, the PACAF and PACOM leadership in Hawaii. They destroy that facility. They destroy a bunch of facilities and with missile strikes, because we don't have an anti-missile defense system capable of stopping it. They also attack every nuclear submarine operating in the Pacific, and they sink almost all of them.
Now, are we talking one or two or 10?
We're talking 15 to 20.
That are out there at any given time.
Yeah, they sink those. They sink, whatever aircraft carriers we've got in there. This is all done within the first 48 hours as their missile stocks start, because they've got thousands of long-range ballistic missiles. They have hundreds of hypersonic weapons, again, for which we have a very limited defense capability. But they don't nuke us. They do all this conventionally. What's our response? Do we nuke Beijing?
No, but I think if these are coming from five or six bases, I don't think we'd hesitate to nuke the bases.
Well, if we put a nuclear weapon on that base, their response is, if you're dropping weapons of mass destruction on our homeland, on our bases in the homeland, we're going to have no choice but to nuke you, and we're going to nuke your base. So if we nuke your bases, like if we nuke Buckley, which is the big Space Force base here outside of Denver, you're going to kill everybody in the Denver area with a nuclear strike on Buckley.
I'm not so sure that people would. I mean, I think it would be a big reach if all of a sudden there's a skirmish for Taiwan for them to bomb Hawaii. I think that would be an upgrade.
Oh no! Why would? Oh no! That this is every scenario I've been reading lately has them hitting Hawaii in some form. Either with small-scale drone attack that's designed to kill leadership there or destroy critical infrastructure.
So what's the solution? Is there one?
The solution is to set up mechanisms such that they are deterred from doing this.
Which would be what?
Which would be a very strong conventional force that could either prevent them from making these initial strikes, or alternatively destroying their conventional capability without having to go nuclear.
Well, I would want, if it was me, and again I don't know anywhere near as much of this stuff, I would want 50 ships capable of doing something instead of 4 capable of doing everything.
That's exactly the thought process, and that's this distributed lethality issue, multiplying the targeting problem.
But that's not happening. All we're worried about is the next aircraft carrier.
No, it's not. And in some cases, Tom, it could be as simple as buying, 15,000 subsurface mines that you drop in the Taiwan Strait or off the coast of China in international waters that sit on the bottom and wait. And if they're activated, they are capable of then either detaching and floating themselves to a target, or they contain torpedoes that they will then fire at, the mines will fire at ships as they pass over.
That's kind of sneaky. I like that. That's kind of sneaky.
And it's cheap. It's much cheaper than having to put ships there. And it could act as a very effective deterrent against an invasion fleet going to Taiwan. It would involve things like putting undersea monitoring on our cables. So we have every reason to believe that both the Russians and the Chinese have used robot vehicles to surveil undersea cross-ocean, transoceanic cable systems that carry most of our internet traffic. and in some cases may actually have mined them, so that when war starts, suddenly our ability to talk to people worldwide, our ability to communicate with our forces, is suddenly cut. We have reason to believe that the Chinese and the Russians have prepared to deploy anti-satellite systems that will take down our satellites.
Well, Tom Clancy wrote about that 25 years ago.
Our GPS and surveillance satellites.
Can a fighter like an F-15, can it take out a satellite?
Yes, with the right missile.
That's what I thought.
We demonstrated that in the mid 1980s. What we think the Chinese might have been doing and preparing for, however, is much more subtle. Because if you start shooting missiles up into orbit, you create these giant clouds of debris when you blow up a satellite. That is as much a risk to your systems as it is to anybody else's. So what you want to do is figure out a way to deorbit or alter your opponent's satellite capability, make it ineffective. And one of the ways you do that is you send microsatellites up into orbit that can fly to and attach themselves to your enemy's satellite systems and either neutralize them electromagnetically so that they just go to inert pieces of junk, or alter their orbits so that they fall back into the Earth's atmosphere. Either way, you effectively negate the satellite capability without creating a giant cloud of debris.
It always stuns me that these countries that are doing this, excuse my French, really don't have a pot to piss in. They don't care about their people. North Korea's got no electricity at night, for God's sake, and they're building missiles. I mean, it's pretty incredible. The idea that Russia, with what they're draining in Ukraine, is making other problems in other parts of the world is astounding to me, really.
Yep. And you know, China's population is that they've got a very rich element in their population.
Well, we did that.
But they've got huge internal demographic issues. But their focus, frankly, the focus of the Chinese government is on basically remedying what they consider to be the colonial embarrassment of the late 19th and early 20th century. Well, and if you read their literature, that's what they say.
Well, we need to get our act together here, and I don't see how that's going to happen. I really don't. I don't see how.
I agree.
We're shoving. We just talked this week. We had Larissa and Russell on yesterday. That are two economists. Well, we got a bunch of economists, but we're talking about what if, you know, some of the stuff that Carl talks about and the amazing amount of money we're shoving at the medical establishment with really not any better outcomes or anything. And you could talk. You could look at anybody we know could pick out two or three prescription drugs that are 15 times what they should cost. And we were just talking yesterday. Larissa was. She's our. Her economics is more towards households and things like that. So, Larissa, what if the normal business now for a family probably is costing them $2,000 a month for, depending on deductibles and all that kind of crap, for insurance? I said, what if every business, somehow or another, that number became $1,500 and you could give the person the extra $500, or the business makes another $500 in profits and declares a dividend. What's a dividend? But I said, what would like $500 in the paycheck of virtually everybody in this country that has insurance right now mean? And she goes, it would mean an incredible difference to just about everybody. I mean, that little bit of nudge is probably where most people are being hurt every month. And all of a sudden now, we would have some money for some of this stuff, Lou. This stuff all. I mean, I know you joke all the time that there's no theme to this show. There is one theme. Everything depends on everything else.
Yeah,
and there is no one topic.
What you're talking about today, to me,
filters right in to what we talked about yesterday.
Yep. Let me just say that. And I'm going to have to run. I know, kidding. Have to stop here in like 4 minutes.
You're going jogging?
Yeah, sort of. I'm going to the airport.
Okay.
We are seeing, at least I'm seeing, the formulation of something I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and that is the idea of some kind of grand strategy starting to take place in terms of our international focus. And that is a movement to extricate ourselves from Europe and try to push more of the defense of Europe onto Europe, at the same time focusing first here in the Western Hemisphere and trying to get our ducks in a row here, because we realize that our position in the Western Hemisphere has been undermined by China and Russia and the presence of these two entities on our doorstep. A movement there, at the same time a movement going to confront China. We just yesterday authorized a huge weapons purchase for Taiwan.
This is a week after the administration said China can have NVIDIA's best chips. What are we doing? How are we doing both of these things?
I think it's a carrot stick approach, but I see some glimmer of as I said, a grand strategy here, which is to secure the Western Hemisphere to whatever extent we can, and at the same time confront China with some resolve with respect to both Japan and Taiwan and the Philippines and to a lesser extent Australia. And that push is what is part of what you're seeing here.
Well, I think we shouldn't be making an enemy out of Canada if we're going to do that, because we could use them.
The Canadians are absolutely useless in terms of military power.
Well, they were with us on the beaches in World War II, and they helped us out in Iraq and other places.
That Canada is long gone.
Well, we need to get them back.
I agree, and that's one of the reasons he's whacking them, to try to get them to spend more on their defense.
I don't know, whatever, but the inconsistency here is befuddling me.
I admittedly, it's not a straight line of every single thing we're doing is consistent. It's a push-pull kind of an operation.
Because what you just said here this morning on the show, I would absolutely take that if I was president and say, okay, how do we make this happen? I would do what you said this morning is so educational, I can't believe it.
I think you are seeing some of that happening right now, and I'm hoping that we're getting a clearer picture. I know I'm seeing some of it with in the Air Force and some of the Air Force stuff that I'm seeing. And maybe we're getting there with the Navy, but these are hard issues that require focus and money and effort and will.
Can you imagine, Lou, somebody standing up and saying, these aircraft carriers are nice, but boy, oh boy, they look vulnerable to me. We better try a different way. I can't imagine somebody doing that.
Those voices have been in the Navy for a long time, but they're starting to rise to a little more preeminence now.
All right.
Let me clarify one thing I said last week. We were talking about interdiction on shipping. The interdiction that's going on right now and that was announced, the blockade that was announced earlier, is on stateless vessels. These are vessels that are flying either false flags or flying no flag, and that are not properly or not registered. Those vessels can be interdicted and stopped anytime.
I don't disagree. The question is, I don't know if I trust our guys. They're pulling people over here that are citizens. When they say they have a warrant, they don't care. I mean, I don't know if I believe them. But that's I hope I can, Lou. Anyway, buddy, where are you off to?
I'm going back home.
All right.
So,
fly safe.
I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
No, we're going to get you on with Kevin. We'll get you on with Kevin next week. Either Wednesday or Friday. We'll do something. We'll
talk
track
to you later.
Okay. SP Futures up 28, NASDAQ Futures up 203. Again, we're bouncing back. Yesterday, we were down 418 on the NASDAQ and down 78 in the S&P. So we're trying to do a Fibonacci replacement. We're not there yet. Do we have our guys? Speaking of Fibonacci,
yes, we do.
These two guys, did you guys know Fibonacci?
Now, you're talking about mathematics, I think.
Well, he was about 800 years old. I wonder if you ever met the guy.
I think I bought a pizza in South Philly from a guy with that name.
Yeah, and neither one of you do. What do you guys got to go with the big, big, huge beard like Fibonacci had? It shows something. I don't know what it shows, but
Well, you know, I've had a beard ever since the then Attorney General John Ashcroft.
Oh, God.
He said, anyone who has a beard is a terrorist. Well, I didn't have a beard then, but I said, okay, well, if you want to be that way, you jerk, I'm going to have a beard.
God. Andrew, we have you as well.
Reporting for duty, sir.
How are you guys? What's been the week? All kinds of crazy stuff. I tried to listen to this thing last night, and I didn't realize he was locked in at 15 minutes. I'm like, how could they be summarizing? And it's only like 16 minutes after the hour, but they were.
I've spared myself the high blood pressure and did not watch it live, but the clips I've seen of it reminds me of Adolf in the bunker.
Yeah.
You know, screaming for generals who didn't exist. I mean, why scream at and then be surrounded by all the Christmas decorations? Seemed like an Ebenezer Scrooge moment for him.
Well, just he was ranting and raving about the budget's deficits being caused by Biden, just let the record reflect. Now, I know there's COVID in here, and before everybody gets involved in ranting and raving and taking sides, the last 4 years of Obama's, the total budget deficit, according to the U.S. stats, is $2.5 trillion, which is a lot. During Trump's 4 years, it was $5.56, and during Biden's 4 years, $7.15. And my point that I will defend to those right and left, if you look at a string of deficits and other than the few Clinton years, virtually you can't tell when one person gets into office and one person leaves. The trend is unmistakable. Every year it grows, for God's sake. Maybe right. Not every year, but it's pretty darn. There's a site here that anybody can go to. It's fiscaldatatreasury.gov or something. And all the way back to the last year we had any kind of a surplus was 2001, and I'm not so sure that was even really a surplus. I think that might have been funny money, but every year since then, it went flying up after that, and then the next year that was close was 2007. Who was in office 2007? I don't even remember. Was that Obama?
Oh, that was W.
Okay, so it was. And then it went up from 2007, 0.16 trillion, which would be, you know, 160 billion. Then the next year was 0.45. Then we had 1.42 in 2009. What was so bad about 2009? Well, that was the year after the 2007-8 fiasco, when we bailed all those people out. We immediately ballooned up to 1.42. Then we were, the next 3 years were a disaster, 1.29, 1.30. And down to, by 2015, we were down to 0.44. Now, when I say 0.44, we're talking trillions here. Do you guys even know how much is $1 trillion? Could you, $100 bills, could you even get $1 trillion on an airplane? I don't think you could you?
Well, looking at Elon Musk's last financial estimate of his worth, over $600 billion, he may become the first trillionaire, so... but I would think he could not get all that money on an airplane.
I actually did. You know what? I'm going to say one of you guys remembers this. There actually was, when we were shipping the $100 bills over to Afghanistan to try and pay off the people.
Right.
I actually read an article about how many $100 bills, how many pallets of $100 bills you could get on a, what's the littler, not the huge plane, but the smaller plane, the C-130 or something?
Yeah.
It was like, you know, a couple $1 billion in hundreds or something.
I remember writing a story back in Iraq, the same thing. There were pallets full of U.S. $100 bills and also Iraqi dinars. I don't know where they got those from, but they were just tossing them around like footballs in some warehouse. And here's the bad part of that. There was never any accounting for all that cash.
Wow.
Well, and you've touched on something in the big picture, that part of the spending is to remediate the disaster before in some of these situations, like COVID or the financial panic and crisis 2007-2008. But in Iraq, and I've talked to people involved in that operation, you know, they come back and they have their explanations of what would seem inexplicable, and it's that they were trying to under orders make the best of a situation where we'd gotten into these wars and we needed to get the people on our side, and they couldn't figure out who the people to get on our side were, so they'd just go somewhere and hand out money. And so it's crazy, it's outrageous, it's horrible, but it's only partly the idea of handing out the money. It's what genius got us into these wars to begin with.
Well, yeah. Well, we fixed them, though, Andrew, because due to inflation, the $100 bill is only worth $50 now.
Yeah, well, your last segment where you're talking about the current situation, it makes this very appropriate. And as you said, it's all connected.
I mean, isn't it amazing how I have... You guys, who I mean, you'll admit you're outliers, right? I mean, how many, in a nice way? I mean, that everything you say is connectable to a lady who's teaching home economics for people, not how to bake. I mean, talking about, you know, how to manage your money and all those other kinds of stuff to a professor at Indiana. It's all the same subject. We all connect, just like kind of a different part of the same subject. It's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe there's a glitch in the matrix.
yeah, I mean it. But I mean, what isn't connected? I mean, when you talk about massive budget deficits and people being broke.
Well, heck, we're seeing the same prices in the stores, aren't we?
I think the store part. I mean, a lot of the stuff that people, as you know, I've never wanted to put your finger on one or two items. Because that's not how you judge inflation. Inflation is the amount of money in the pool, and there's a big difference between general inflation and whether the price of eggs went up and down last week. Because eggs are a competitive good, and so is gasoline. Now, if the economy is actually slowing a hair, which I think it is, and in China seemingly slowing more than that, the gasoline going from $3.50 to $3 a gallon has nothing to do with government genius. It's just there's a slowing in the demand, and oh, by the way, there's a lot of supply, you know. But that doesn't mean that the next time when Andrew's 5-year-old nice car needs a transmission, he walks in and he goes, "What do you mean 10 grand? It used to be 2 grand." That's still hanging there. I mean, it's out there. Your services are, your lawyer's fees are up. All stuff you don't normally do. Your emergency room visits, that just hasn't hit you yet because you haven't cut your finger yet. That's the part. Oh, I need an air conditioner for the house. How much? The last time it was nowhere near that. I mean, that's the stuff I think that's kind of lurking around. You can't just point to the price of eggs because they go up and down by bird flu, basically.
Well, exactly. And speaking of air conditioning or heating system, you know, we're into the winter. My system is still going. And this may be too boring or personal, but I'll just say I got a deal at a place where somebody gave me a free inspection. They say, "Oh, you need a new system." And I said, "How much would it cost?" They said, $13,000. This is about 5 years ago. And I said, "Really?" I skipped it. And the thing's still working. And so part of inflation or savings is things we avoid, fortunately, if we can. But sometimes it's based on bad advice, what we think we need.
Yeah, Andy, but that your condo association once you get rid of that potbelly stove, don't they?
Well, I keep it on the balcony, so they let it go.
My place still has the building so old. It's still got the little, it's got the what looks like a brick fireplace with nothing there, and you can see the little looks like a dish, a circular thing on the top where the stove used to pile into. Remember those?
Well, at least you're saving on chimney sweeps. Their union is getting more active now, and they want
benefits.
Well, I've been dying to talk to you guys on a couple of subjects. One, and Lou just piled on this morning on the same thing, talking about the difference in the Pentagon and how they're not getting the right stuff, and this idea of a conventional war, we're so far behind, and if we're not going to nuke people, we better, which, you know, he's not advocating we do, we better brush up on the other stuff because we're way behind. But it also, I don't know if I did send you guys that article about the shipbuilding. I knew we were down. I had no idea we were down that low. We only have six left, and China's got... How does this, over a long period of time, get there? What's the difference between the people in Congress now than the people 25... I mean, Wayne, you were in the Navy.
Yeah.
If you were in Congress, you would try your best to not let us get down to where we can't build any ships anymore. Why isn't there anybody... I'm not talking about your politics. I'm just talking about your knowledge. How did that knowledge go?
I would be very suspicious, too, though, because one thing I saw when I was in the Navy, and even afterwards when I was a contractor for a while, and then got into policy issues in D.C., is that the military always seems to, when it's especially around budget time, they always overestimate the threat and underestimate their capabilities. This just seems to, and it doesn't matter who the president is, who's in control of Congress. It's always, you get all the stakeholders in there when they're starting to come up with the budget, the defense budget, which is what I mean, it's the most we spend on anything right now. And they're all, and these generals and admirals and GS-18s or they're all coming in there, and we can't do this, and I'd be sympathetic to real problems, but I'd also be pretty cynical when it would come to these pie in the sky issues. I remember John Lehman, the Secretary of Navy, he was all a big cheerleader. Reagan said, "I want a 600 ship Navy," and you remember they brought battleships out of mothballs. Where do you get the crew? They were actually bringing in guys in their 70s who were on these battleships in World War II. A lot of them thought it was great to go back on active duty. You get off the bar stool at the VFW and the American Legion, you're back on active duty, because they were the only ones who knew how to fire these massive guns.
It seems like, as Lou was talking about, and I kind of... From time to time, on the show, what was the when we had the big buildup, when Trump had the big buildup in the Mediterranean, we put a second aircraft carrier or something. One of the supply ships for the aviation fuel ran aground, and we didn't have another one or something. it's I don't think either one of you guys, if somebody were saying, by the way, do we have enough minesweepers? Do we have enough? Even when aircraft carrier is nuclear, all the planes on it use fuel, right? So you still got to refuel the thing, even though the aircraft carrier doesn't need it. Logistics is what made us the country we are today after World War II, right?
Yeah, but you mentioned minesweepers. Way back when, I was actually on an exchange program with the Belgian Navy. Now, people would think, well, Belgium, do they even have a Navy? And their Navy consisted mostly of minesweepers, former U.S. minesweepers. But what Trump is doing, and I looked at this national security strategy, it's basically Trump has decided we will no longer be involved with collective defense organizations like NATO, for example. We're going to do it all on our own. But since the end of World War II, groups like NATO have basically divvied up responsibilities for different things among the members. And now, obviously, with a much enlarged NATO, including Finland and Sweden, that have pretty good military capabilities, they've divvied out more. So if the U.S. is going to withdraw from NATO and these other relationships, yeah, we'll have to talk about minesweepers again. By the way, the ones I was on, they were made of wood.
Well, they used to make some of them is up in Sturgeon Bay.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. I think the one I was, it had been an ex-U.S. minesweeper. I think that's exactly where it was constructed.
And I remember seeing one when I was real young, and they are made of wood. I mean, obviously, yeah. If you got a metal, you don't want to bump up against a metallic bomb if you're.
That's right. They're not the kind of vessel you want to be on during a major storm in the North Atlantic, which I was on. Even the captain was in bed sick.
Oh, God.
bobbed like a cork.
But, I mean, just some of the stuff. What was it in the article I sent you guys? We've got, like, four icebreakers, and we're trying to keep the Arctic open? I mean,
here again, Finland. Yeah, we're getting Finland to build ours, too. And the Finns and the Norwegians and the Canadians, they provide a lot of our icebreaking capability. But see, Trump wants to walk away from all that and say, well, Putin can have Europe and I'll take the Western Hemisphere and China can have Asia. George Orwell predicted that in 1984. That's how the world would be divided. But I don't think it works in practice.
But, I mean, if you're in Congress, you know, I'd love to see you two guys in Congress. And somebody said, well, we need to build, like, five more of these kinds of ships. And go, we don't have any shipyards anymore. And I got to believe you'd say, what do you mean we don't have any shipyards anymore?
Yeah,
where'd they all go? I mean, I mean, six doesn't seem like very many, does it?
No. And... And like we have to get our so-called allies, or what used to be our allies, I guess, with this new strategy, we have to get the Finns to build our icebreakers. And we rely. What my point is that we have relied on our partners for a lot of when you're talking about a coalition, you remember George H.W. Bush and W. Bush, Coalition of the Willing. Well, it was all based on this collective defense. And we're the only country in NATO that ever activated Article 5 because of 9/11. And now we're prepared to tell the Baltic countries, Poland and others, you're on your own. Sorry, guys.
Did you ever ride on an icebreaker?
I've never been on an icebreaker, no.
I saw one years and years ago. I mean, you guys probably know, but for the listeners, how does an icebreaker work? You probably know, you're in the Navy.
Well, it has a reinforced hull, especially in the front of the icebreaker, which basically it comes down on the ice. And you know, breaks it up.
It doesn't crush through it. Nothing strong enough for that.
It doesn't crush through it. It basically uses the weight of the vessel to come down over the ice.
Round bottom, almost like a bathtub.
Yeah.
They said it's the worst thing to be in any kind of high seas, because all it does is pitch. But Andrew, what it does, the thing literally rolls up on the ice, and the thing is so heavy. It's amazingly heavy that it then breaks the ice down into the water. I mean, it's nothing like you would envision if you just thought about it.
That makes sense. It makes me think that we look at these Western movies, the covered wagons and going to the West, and you think about it, it's a pretty rough ride. There's no springs on a lot of those wagons.
Remember the commercial where
the icebreaker.
Remember the years and years ago commercial where the guy put the Monroe shocks on the stagecoach. He's driving. You see these big Monroe shots of the stagecoach, and the driver's going, "Man, does this make the stagecoach ride better or something?" The God. So what's I've been doing too much talking. What's current in your world? What's what have you guys been doing the last week, or is the holiday stuff? I mean, no big meetings or anything.
Wayne had two. Wayne came up a week and a half ago with two new books that he's written, and why don't you tell him about the one about the spies, Wayne?
Well, I decided to write a book on where what hotels, especially hotel bars, hotel lobbies, and various other clubs around the world where spies hang out, and where you know spies and diplomats come together, and that draws together also femme fatales and various
financiers,
grifters and mercenaries and all kinds of international aid workers, and some of these places have very storied pasts.
This is like the intergalactic bar in Star Wars, right?
Yeah, sort of like that. some are lowbrow, and others are, your Ritz-Carlton type hangouts. But it was actually kind of fun to do. Basically, if you're in that business and you want to pick up intelligence, this is where you hang out. They're all located. The vast majority of these places are where there's a lot of international organizations, and it's not New York or Washington that has the majority of these. The city with the most international organizations of any other place is Vienna, Austria.
Really?
And second is Geneva, Switzerland. And then you get into, then you have Brussels and The Hague.
Right, so you had to go to Vienna and go to every one of these bars?
If I ever could talk somebody into doing a TV series on that, that would be one of the requirements. Why I have to actually go to these places on the producer's dime.
Vienna's beautiful. I was there. We did some lecturing over there. Boy, what a nice town.
It was one of these places that some places are just great walking towns, and that was one of them. Of course, Paris and London are great walking towns. You just start walking around, you see a lot of stuff.
I'm going to say that the two-legged scenery in Vienna is about as nice as I've ever seen.
Yeah.
That's just, lobbing that one in there,
Yeah.
But, so Wayne started with an idea, and I thought, how's he going to make a book out of this? But it ended up fairly short descriptions of the places, but 470 pages. And
wow.
He brought some copies up to Washington, and we have to do some research, even though we knew.
Yeah, because some of them are. Yeah, some of the places in Washington are, of course, feature prominently in the book.
Which are the ones in Washington or New York? If you could name.
Well,
a few.
The one you were at, where you saw Newt Gingrich, the Round Robin at the Willard. That's where a lot of diplomats from certain organizations hang out.
What about the one across the street? We were in the ones down in the basement. At the Hayes Healy or something Healy or
You're talking about the Hay Adams.
Hey, Adam.
off the record. Yeah, that's in there as well, right on the other side of Lafayette Park. Then you have your front of the mill Ritz-Carlton bar and over toward Georgetown, and one that's in a former pharmacy on the campus at GW University, where a lot of State Department and World Bank IMF people hang out.
Really?
It's around 20th Street, and what it's called the Tonic at Quigley's Pharmacy. That's one of the places we want to take a look at. And Wayne had actually had an assignation. It wasn't a romantic one, but with a source there, and so years ago, and so you know, he came in with a copy of his book, and we made some friends, and
we call it research.
We got a free drink,
but we got honorable mention in the book.
You realize this is all tax deductible, all these drinks.
Yeah,
this is,
yeah, you see, the plan is we go to the bars that are mentioned in the book, and we get at least one free drink out of them.
You would think. Is there a place in Chicago, and what are a few in New York? Plus, I got to ask you about your...
Nothing in New York. I mean, nothing in Chicago, but in New York, most of them around the United Nations building. I'm trying to think.
Is there a bar in the United Nations or no?
Yes, there is. I've been there. It's the Delegates Lounge. And you can. It used to be very popular because after New York banned smoking, that did not apply to an international, you know, it's not even U.S. property, it's international territory. So the only place you could drink and smoke in New York at for a certain period of time before they banned it at the UN was the Delegates Lounge at the UN.
Did you guys ever go to the King Tut's bar in the St. Regis, the cigar bar?
I've not been there.
Yeah, we used to go there when I was on the board of the SIBO, and God, all you come out of there and all you did was stink. It was bad. Are you still? We're going to go to break here in a couple of minutes, but are you still writing your Epstein book? Where is that thing? By the way, as you mentioned earlier, you were wrong. Oh, the Defense Department now is $931 billion, and interest on national debt is $967.
Ooh,
that's troubling, isn't it?
Yeah. Well,
that's pretty scary. Did you where do you the Epstein thing comes out with new stuff, and then it kind of goes back, and Trump says something else and tries to keep it off? Where is it?
Well, I'll jump in on that. First of all, if your question was directed at me, I'm not writing an Epstein book.
No, Wayne was, wasn't he?
No, I'm not. I have written, well, Andy and I have both written about Epstein back in 2017. We worked on an Epstein story.
You sent me something recently. Sent me something recently that had to do with not just the pervert part, but all the different people who have been co-opted, and how could this happen on our soil without the CIA either knowing about it or not knowing about it or whatever.
There's a massive network, and I think this, if there's any, you know, obviously Trump has a lot of interest in suppressing these Epstein files, but he's not the only one. Look at some of these international financial people that are involved supposedly. You got major hedge fund officials. You got, of course, now the Deutsche Bank, and I guess it's the Citibank turning over some Epstein records to Democrats on the House Oversight Committee and to Senator Wyden over on the Senate side. So we don't know what's eventually going to come out, but there's a lot of vested interests that do not want to see these Epstein files.
And I know you're going to break, but let me just plant a quick thought. The prosecutor in Florida, Alexandria Ocasio, who Trump appointed later as labor secretary, but he's the guy who gave Epstein the sweetheart deal. He also was the prosecutor against the biggest whistleblower against Swiss banks in U.S. history, Bradley Birkenfeld, who tried to blow the whistle on 19,000 U.S. tax cheats, and Birkenfeld was the only one to go to be criminally prosecuted.
Wow. Well, I mean, you know, when we're talking about Trump, we don't want to talk necessarily about the individual, but if you're him, which we aren't, if you did something untoward with somebody underage, and I'm not going to accuse, if you did, I suspect most people would not want that to come out. But if it turns out that somebody took films of it and sold it to the Russians and the Bulgarians and whoever the hell else, I think you'd be pretty pissed off at that, wouldn't you?
Well, that's a longer thing than...
Let's save that for a break.
I'll just say, for Wayne and me, who have investigated this for over a decade, that's not an if, it is.
But I mean, that would pretty much piss you off, wouldn't it?
He's actually, again, longer.
Let's go to break and then we'll flush this out. SP Futures up 42. NASDAQ Futures up 275. We'll get the whole rip here. We're coming back about halfway yesterday, maybe a little more halfway than NASDAQ right now. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
How would you like to save money on nearly all your prescription drugs? We've set up a special toll-free number for the RX Outreach Program. They're a nonprofit company whose mission it is to make prescription drugs more affordable to the masses. They don't take insurance, and in many cases, your prescriptions are even cheaper than your co-pays. They carry thousands of different prescription drugs, so whatever you're taking, there's a good chance they have it. No coupons are required, and this is not a discount card. It is pure savings on your prescription drugs. They specialize in generic meds for any chronic health needs you have. Call with your prescription and find out for free how little you can pay for your prescription drugs. Remember, we don't take insurance, so call right now.
800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. That's 800-586-9885.
This is a true sad story for ADT, the leader in home security systems. My favorite dog, Oliver, was stolen from our garage recently. If I had a camera system installed in my home from ADT, I would have known exactly what car possibly pulled up in my driveway and stole my little friend. If I had a security system from ADT, my dog would still be here. I called ADT this weekend, and they're coming out in a few days to install a camera and a new security system. Unfortunately, it's a little too late for me. Listen, protect everyone you love in your family. Call ADT now. Have them come out and give you a quote to install a full security system in your home. Don't let it be too late for you. Call right now.
Paid for by the Home Security Hotline. 800-200-6543. 800-200-6543. 800-200-6543. That's 800-200-6543.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
We're back.
Well, we're back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. We have some kind of weird stuff here today. That the CPI just came out with 2.7 in November. I don't believe that for a second. But I also, I'm looking at the CPI report from the government that I normally get, and the darn thing is still blank. So I don't know what the story is there, if they changed it or whatever, but I'll find it as we're talking. S&P futures like it, though, up 42. NASDAQ futures down up 280. I guess if you just tell people there's no inflation, there's no inflation. And gasoline prices are down. I think a few food prices are down, but I don't know what else is down. And I can't go through the detail because it's not there. I'm not sure why. DAX up 64.3%. FTSE down 17.2%. CAC round up 17.2%. So not much going on there. We're in Asia. Nikkei down 5.10, it's 1%. Hang Seng up 29.1. Shanghai up 6, call that flat. So not much going on there. Bonds, right now, the 10-year is actually down 0.2 ticks to 4.13. 30-year is down 1 tick to 4.81. Oil, which even with all the stuff in Venezuela, is still 56.29, up 35 cents. Brent up 27 cents, 59.95. Gold, down 21 bucks, but still pretty darn high. 43.52. Silver's down $1.04 with this inflation number coming out. So those guys are taking a little bit of a hit here. They've been way up. Foreign exchange, we have the dollar's actually up a little bit. is the central banks in Europe held all their rates steady. So the euro is still 117.4, kind of the same as it has been. British pound 134. Again, these are up from a couple of weeks ago. Crypto up 2,100, 88,103. So it's finally making a bump up here. Jimmy, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Well, on the inbound, let's take traffic today. Inbound Kennedy, 29 minutes from the Byrne Jane interchange. Going to Edens, we are at 44 minutes from the inbound from Lake Cook, so that's gone up. The inbound Eisenhower from Wolf is 39, and the inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is 36. Weather in Chicago, well, it's raining. It's going to be a high of 50, and then we are going to have rain turn to snow and a low of 15 tonight. In Phoenix, we are at 51 degrees with a high of 76. In sports, not a much went on last night. The Bulls won. They beat the Cavaliers 127 to 111. And tonight's NFL game will be the Rams versus Seattle Seahawks. The other news in Chicago, the Bears once again are now moving, saying, hey, Indiana, do you want a stadium? We want a stadium. Do you want to pay for it?
Yep.
And back to you.
So you guys, would it be the Indiana Bears? What do you think?
Well, my family has roots in Decatur, Illinois. And, of course, the Bears were originally down there.
The Decatur Staleys.
Exactly.
Can you name the only two teams still playing that were in the original group in the Hupmobile Stadium in Canton, Ohio?
I cannot.
Well, take a second.
What is it?
It's the Bears and the Cardinals.
Well, it used to be the Chicago Cardinals.
Yeah, they were the original team, and I think Green Bay came in like 6 months later and whatever, because the Canton Bulldogs were in there and a few other teams you would never recognize, and they were one of the Green Bay was late, and then Detroit came in, and New York Giants were right after. I think the Steelers were pretty close. So originally they all kind of trickled in, but anyway.
You know what's amazing is how few people can remember. Maybe just some of us older seniors here, the derivation of some of these names, and so you might find younger people who follow sports but have no idea where, let's say, the name Packers or Pistons might come from, much less the Decatur.
Well, the Bears, I think, was because they went to play in Wrigley Field and
the Cubs, yeah.
Yeah, because of the Cubs. It's kind of a natural sort of thing. And the original Masters of the Midway was the University of Chicago, wasn't the Bears, right?
Yeah, they had a great team, and then the Hutchins abolished football in the 30s.
Yeah, and then they decided to bag it. So, go on with the stuff that Wayne was sending me had to do with all the different people involved in the information from Epstein and all the money, and you guys went through the Maxwell's father and the whole history of it. And I think that even if, you know, I guess if you're compromised, you don't want any of the stuff to come out, but I don't think Bill Clinton and those people knew the depths of what they were getting their ass into, basically, literally.
Yeah, well, I think that's true, yeah. But there are others, I think, absolutely were in it for the purient reasons we've come to discover.
But, I mean, I don't think that they would have been there if they knew their picture would be coming out 20 years later.
No, that's for sure.
You know, why do you suspect here that I'm looking at the consumer price index for all that comes out every month, and now all of a sudden it's the November numbers were there, the yearly, but I don't see any. There's no monthly. Are we not doing a monthly?
Yeah, well, I don't know how anybody in the business of finance can deal with the fact that the Trump administration is either sitting on statistics or cooking them. This is what dictatorships do. This is one of the reasons the Soviet Union collapsed, because they were lying about Well, everything, really.
Well, here's two aspects of the speech, and I had I was at an event last night, so I didn't see it, but I've been reading about it. He went on all three networks, which itself is kind of a scandal because it's out of tradition. Normally they ask, well, what's the big crisis? And here they just, yes, sir, here's your network coverage.
They gave him 15 minutes.
He actually said to the American people that gas had placed it down to $1.99. Now, I think last week we talked about him saying that, and the difference between $2.99 or $2.80, where it is someplace, and $1.99, it's not $1.99 anywhere.
Actually, we're down to about $2.60-something here.
What?
We're down to about $2.60-something here.
Yeah, but that's not $1.99.
No. But we aren't Mississippi either, so.
Yeah.
But the larger point is, following up Wayne, is how can you take it seriously, and yet all three networks just said, well, we don't let Obama or Biden have nationwide addresses because it might be too political, but go ahead, and we can.
Yeah. Well, here's just so. So I don't sound like even more of a dummy than normal. I'm looking at the table one, and this is all blank here because they have an unadjusted percentage change from November 24 to November 25. That's the only number that's in there. The October to November is blank. The August to September is blank. The September to October is blank. August to November is October to November is blank. So we're never going to. So they're telling you year over year it's 2.7 when last time they reported it was 3, but there's no detail in anything here other than year over year.
Well, the part of it, and actually at like a holiday party I was at last night, you're mingling here in Washington with people who work in the government, and you know, privately, people will say, you know, I'm just trying to hang on and not get people upset, and I hope to get a couple more months in at the kind of jobs that compile statistics there or in other places. And it's very much on people's minds. How do I keep my job at least for a few more months when I'm asked to do things? And it might be just don't put in any figures. but there's lots of other situations like that. In fact, well, I don't know if I should get into it, but and part of our research on this book on bars and spies, Wayne and I encountered somebody who had been Doge and got to know firsthand what that was like. I won't get into the details, but, and of course Doge is the term for when Elon Musk came in earlier this year and just started wiping out vast numbers of people. That ended up costing the government money, net loss.
Well, you know what? They're leaving the column out here where they tell you what percentage of the basket it is. That's blank too.
Well, if that was your job, would you want to put a number in there if it wasn't?
Well, hey, I ran into a gentleman last night. We have a meeting for. Well, there was this older judge here in Chicago that everybody really respected, and he was a friend of everybody's, and once every couple of months they would have a night where we would meet in the bar and talk to this guy. And I got to be, you know, not near his friends like the guys that had known him for years, but we became, you know, at least pretty good companions, I think. But he passed, but the group still gets together every couple of months kind of in his name. So we're there last night, and one of the guys is an accountant. He's been accountant for, he does a lot of accounting for small businesses and all this stuff.
And somehow we got on the subject of, you know, the Social Security and the Doge, and I was asking him a couple of questions. He's telling me that he doing some work for a company, I won't say what they did or whatever. There's a Hispanic guy that works there that has had a fake Social Security number for 25 years. Now, he's a regular employee. You know, he's getting a check. So for 25 years, he and the company have been sending money to the Social Security people on a number that essentially doesn't exist. And the guy has a 401k, and now he has to, well, he would like to roll it into an IRA, which is what you do when you retire, right? And the accountant guy didn't think he could do it because his Social Security number is no good. Now, I don't think he's going to get Medicare, and I don't think he's going to get Social Security checks. How the hell do these guys take money on an account they know it's still good for 25 years? And not call the owner up and say, by the way, what are you sending me number for this account for? There is no such account. They just take it?
Who are you saying should have reported this?
Well, the Social Security gets the check every month.
Yeah.
Are you saying the employee should have reported it?
No, I'm saying what does the Social Security number do if you send something in from Andrew and it's on a Social Security number and for 25 years they accept, you know, your payroll tax when there's no account of that number? And then you turn around and say, well, where's my Medicare? And they say, screw you. How does that work?
Well, when I did some work with the Social Security Administration, you know, they do reuse Social Security numbers after a certain period of time. Somebody dies, and their Social Security number can be used by someone else. But granted, it'd be, you know, years between, and there's a set. And I wonder if it's a situation like that, think about the people who were born when there was no Social Security who later qualified for it. And they died in the 60s or whatever. It's quite possible that number could be reused for someone else. It doesn't sound like it could actually happen because the system should kick that back and say, hey, wait a minute, we can't apply this to an account because that account doesn't exist.
Wayne, when I started in business, well, a long time ago, but during the 80s, when virtually, I won't say everybody, but an awful lot of people worked in the kitchens of the restaurants downtown, right?
Oh, yeah.
First of all, originally, you paid the guys cash, okay? And then that, you couldn't do that, right? So then guys would get a Social Security card. But it was a fake card a lot of times. And the restaurants would just send the $300 Social Security into that card. They never got the check back. They never got a call.
Here's one thing that people may not think about, but these federal agencies, let's say, or state agencies or county, they vary widely in their long-term planning on acquiring up-to-date processing equipment or software. And just like on our office upgrades, you know, every few years you got to upgrade it. But at some of these massive agencies, it's such a huge expense that they're kicking the can down the road. And at the IRS, for example, they have really ancient methods in many parts of the system, and probably at other major places, and it takes active administration both in the executive branch and in Congress to say, okay, what exactly is the best software to stay up to date in an economical way? And if you're constantly replacing the administrators, who's going to do it and do it right?
But even Andrew, I don't want to say forever on this subject, even like 15 years ago, you guys remember, you're working and you're 55, and once a year or once a maybe twice a year, you'd get this essentially postcard in the mail.
Yeah.
And then you'd open it up and it'd say, okay, in 1975,
yeah,
you paid in X, you paid in XX, you know, and there's a whole record of everything you've ever paid in.
Yeah.
And so whether it's manual or otherwise, but now if it's PTI Securities, when we used to have, you know, 15 people working here, somebody somewhere, whoever we were using to do our payroll, I don't know if we ever did it manually, but somebody sends in a check to the Social Security and says, wait a minute, there's this Wayne Mattson guy here. Okay, he gets 400 of this into his account and somebody else gets something. Whether it's manual or not, somebody's got to go, wait a minute, who's this Wayne Mattson guy? There is no number like this.
Yeah.
You would think
yeah.
after 25 years, somebody would go, I guess my question is, where do you put the dough? Is there some kind of a slush account, or is it going in his own back pocket, or what?
Well, I think Social Security money just goes into the general account, and one of the kind of scare tactics for young people is, well, you don't actually have an account, your audience, and of course you are sophisticated, it's not like the Scrooge McDuck comic books where there's like a money bin that's filled with
what if you sold widgets and all of a sudden you got some big check one day, here's a check for my widgets, and you go, who is this guy? What would you do with it? Just cash it and not tell anybody?
Well, that sounds like the tax collectors here in Florida. Each county has a tax collector, and when it comes time to pay your tax, which is based down here as for your registration for cars and whatnot, they make you sign. So you sign your, or you make out your check to the person's name, and then comma tax collector.
Really?
Well, we had one character here who was a buddy of Matt Gaetz up here in Osceola County outside of Orlando, who said, oh, it's got my name on there. Well, I'm just going to go cash his check and get the cash. And, of course, him and Gaetz were using, I hate to tell you what him and Gaetz were using the money for, but it had to do with younger women.
Oh, God.
But who in their right mind, when I first got here, I said, who makes a check out to the actual person? At least when you do it with, you pay your federal tax, it's to the U.S. Treasury, not to Scott Bessent, although he might want that. Maybe he wants that to start. I don't know.
What right now, where do you think, after, you know, last night's speech and stuff, I'm starting to, it's not like people who are, you know, Trump supporters or Republican or conservative want to flee back to the current iteration of the Democratic Party. As a matter of fact, Jimmy and I had a discussion on the way, and I said, I think he's slipping just about everywhere. That's just my opinion. But I don't, someplace somewhere, the Democrats have to have a plan other than just not Trump. I mean, is there anybody that's going to have that? I mean, right now, what am I going to do, flee from Trump to Mayor Johnson in Chicago? That's one hell of a leap.
Well, the famous Will Rogers statement 100 years ago, I belong to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Well,
and it's still true, because your question, I think, assumes that somebody's running things, whereas in fact it's a bunch of people that want to advance themselves and ultimately a concerned and informed public needs to say, no, you do not advance, this person or group or wing should advance, and we've all got to make that decision. But there's no organized entity that's that determinative.
Andrew, why is that? I've read stuff that the National Committee for the Republicans gets regular donations, has software that's pretty darn good, they're pretty well organized, yet the Democratic group, if somebody's raising money, they try and grab money from the candidate. Nobody sends them a check, really. Maybe somebody does. And their software is lousy, everything. What is the historical difference there that has caused all that? Or is that description true? And if it
I think it's generally accurate. And I think part of it is that if some of these major donors to the Republican Party, particularly, they're involved in government contracts, and so it's an investment, and they whatever they're spending can come back manyfold in benefits, and whether it's a government contract or gutting of regulation. Look at the crypto industry now, which made a major, major play in the last election and is continuing. And they want crypto to be part of the regular banking system, but obviously without the controls of what the SEC and the banking systems normally have, because you don't know where the money came from.
I don't know if that dog's going to hunt, but how do you argue with, well, he's not here, but my buddy John, who spent a show with me, and he's, well, he claims he's very conservative. I don't know if he is or he isn't, but he said that even though he was more Republican, he goes, Obama in 8 years did more for rich people than any Republican ever did, and that another 8 years of Obama would be perfect. When you talk about contracts and stuff, people still got them under him. It's not like they didn't give him personally money, but somebody still gets the contracts under the Democrats. I mean, it's the same people.
Well, exactly, and both Wayne and I have investigated the Obama administration, and let's just leave it that he's a lot more connected to the establishment before he became president.
And so was his family.
Yeah, and the image that a community organizer becomes president, that's only part of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. What's the rest of the story? Very well connected.
Would you guys want to go through that some week? Because, I mean, I think it's pretty interesting. I mean, everybody ran against somehow fell afoul of something.
Right. I was trying to think one time, we touched on this before. It wasn't just a Ryan who was married to the Star Trek person. It was a guy's name, Baron Hill, who was a Democrat that was going to... there was a Democrat who was well-placed to win in the primary, and his divorce...
Yeah, papers. So there was a guy in the primary there, and then then they brought in who was the black guy they brought in from out of state to run against them as the Republican?
Oh, Alan Keyes.
Where did they find that guy?
He's from Maryland, and he was like ambassador to the UN under I forget, maybe it was goes back to Reagan. I don't know, but yeah, he was just somebody to fill in the blank.
But, I mean, how do you even bring somebody in from out of state to run for Senate? I mean,
it's carpet bagging. Look, there's this guy named Daryl Issa who lost his reelection in California, and then ran in another district out there that was more conservative, won back in Congress, and now with what's happening with redistricting in California, he says, "Oh, he's moving to Texas. He's going to run in a safe seat there." You got these, you got these carpet baggers.
If I wanted to run, I mean, is every state of their own? If I wanted to run for representative in Ohio, could I still move in, or is it?
There's usually a residency requirement minimum. I think it varies.
But there's the enforcement is very difficult. It used to be the public would be outraged, the local newspaper would make a big thing of it, but we see a lot of senators and others who maybe get an apartment temporarily in the place where they want to run. I mean, in Alabama, for example, where they don't hardly have any newspapers anymore, the U.S. Senator, Tommy Tuberville, it's well known that he lives in Florida, and he's got, some little spot in Alabama, but he spends almost all of his time on the...
And Josh Hawley, he lives in Virginia and apparently is using some relative sister's address in Missouri to claim...
Who's the guy that lost in Indiana? Was it last time or the time before? Because was it by? Because he'd moved to Washington like 90% of the time, and nobody even saw him in Indiana anymore. Was that why they threw him out? It was somebody in Indiana.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's very common, actually. And they usually, as Wayne was saying, have some footprint back in the district, and it's just a question of whether the public is incensed enough about
it. Yeah, and if people looked at Mike Johnson's current living arrangements in Washington, D.C., they might be somewhat...
Well, he's not staying in his office like the guy from Wisconsin, is he?
No, far from it. He's living with some religious guy and who's got his own issues. And well, let's just put it this way: he's not as much of a holy roller and abider by the Ten Commandments as he likes people to think he is.
Okay. How many guys stay in their office like the guy in Wisconsin, or do they ban that now?
It depends on the size of the office. Andy and I have been to many of these offices. Some of them have their own bathroom facilities. And even if you don't have the full-blown shower thing, some of them use the gym. At least on the house side, there's a gym there that they use at. But I think in most cases I've seen is if they've got a big permanent residence in back in their own state district, whatnot, they'll find some cheap apartment.
That's most of it. But let me close with a kind of vehement comment coming from a close friend of mine. Gal who worked for many years on congressional staff, and she said it's disgusting that these people would live in their offices. She said, when I came to Washington, I was making $12,000 a year, and I got my own apartment. And why do we have these congressmen who live in their offices, and we got to work around that.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, guys, I'm going to try and get you on. We can't go two Thursdays without you, so we're going to try and get you on someplace. If it's not by next Thursday, have a Merry Christmas. You guys are home, or you're both at home for Christmas, I assume?
Yeah, I'm sticking close to home.
I hear it's too hot in Florida, but the guys are complaining.
Well, it's been chilly here, at least in the Tampa area, the last few days.
Okay. Well, we hope to get a holiday surprise with an invitation. So, if not, you have a great holiday.
Everybody have a good one. And we'll try and get you guys, like I say, on somewhere. No way I can wait till the middle of January to talk to you guys. SP Futures up 52. NASDAQ Futures up 337. Nice job, Jimmy. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.